Action.
Okay, so it's my pleasure to introduce or reintroduce someone who has served as chair of our Board of Trustees, was a student of Gordon Pask, and I think most of us know him from in many hats. What he hasn't done for us lately is perform music, but we're going to get him to do that soon. All right.
I hope so.
Paul Pangaro.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Michael. Thank you. And my thanks to Michael for making it possible and easy for me to be here today. Can I ask one indulgence of the speaker, which is all of you who have devices, turn them on, turn them off if you wish, turn them on vibrate, but especially the laptops and prevent them from going ding because it makes me crazy. Thank you very much. So I come today from the College of Creative Studies, which are probably not known to you. The master's level programs, of which there are four, and I hope you can see these. I wasn't planning for such a little screen. Transportation Design, Color and Materials, which is a term of art in trans design. Integrated Design and Interaction Design, and as you might guess, I'm involved in the Interaction Design program. Although very often people say to me, Paul, what is interaction design? And I immediately say to them, well, have you had any interactions today, Tom? How's it been going? Been going well or poorly?
All right,
good. Any of them not go so well for anybody here? Any poor interactions they didn't really care? Yes, so I see someone in the back says yes. Those interactions that don't go really well, those are the ones we want to design to be better. Now, I've played a trick. I've turned it into an interaction, right? So instead of just giving you a pat answer, I tried to make something happen across the divide. That's also the challenge of interaction design. The other story I like to tell about interaction design is of John Cleese, the world-famous comedian, of course, from Monty Python. And he was about to be interviewed, and the video guy starts the interview by saying, Mr. Cleese, you're a very funny man. And Cleese frowns, and he won't have any of it. And he says, no, it depends on who I'm with. So this also is the goal of interaction design, to create conditions to be with that you want to be in. Or better said, perhaps, conditions such that you can be who you want to be. Or if Heinz were here, he would correct me, he would say, as you want to become, not just simply to be. So this is the context of interaction design. As I begin the presentation today, I want to say that my focus is on the concept of resilience. As many of you know, the word has been around for quite a long time and is often applied to personal things and to grief, to dealing with complexities in childhood and so on and so forth. My focus is more on my domain of expertise, which is that of social systems and, of course, say it with me, please, cybernetics. So I want to focus on that, and in particular with systems that have conversations, namely social systems. Organizations of all kinds, businesses, schools, nonprofits, governments. I wish Bob Knisely were here. He would want to be talking about governments, I'm sure. In order to do this in a very short period of time, however, I warn you that I have to test your resilience. So fasten your seatbelts, as they say. It's going to be a bumpy ride. Now, even before I can talk about resilience, I would need to talk about design. And design in the context that I would like to speak of is in these challenges to the 21st century. And these are the important challenges, not just of design, but to design. These are non-trivial, as we might say, and we might try to categorize them as simple problems, complex problems, or wicked problems, a term of art. It's a very specific meaning. This is not just really hard problems, but they have a class of their own, the strict sense of Rittle and Weber. These are problems that actually defy problem statement. It's very difficult to say what the problem is, to agree on goals, to agree on when we might be finished. We're never done with a wicked problem. You never completely eradicate it. And in fact, their preferred term was to tame rather than to solve. And these are very, very, very important distinctions in my mind. So these are all wicked problems. And my belief is that design has its responsibility to attend to these problems. And it's that context that I want to create as I speak today of resilience.
here's a wonderful quote that you will recognize and that Pile referred to the idea of yesterday. I invite you to read it. I hope you can all see. So this is an invitation as we seek change, as we seek to design, to make something better, to improve an interaction. We can ask ourselves, what do we want to conserve? What are the values we want to conserve? What do we want, and how do we get it? Of course, from Maturana. This is a fabulous way to frame design, in my point of view, and it works very, very well with both students and organizational settings when you want to ask the question, not just what do we want to have that is new, but what do we want to keep? What are our values and so on? So this is back to the notion of design. And to speak of design is to speak of cybernetics. What? Huh? Yes. Yes. So let's begin with a quote that I want to thank Jude for suggesting. The art of maintaining equilibrium, we know what equilibrium is, I hope, in a world of constraints and possibilities, a wonderful quote from Ernst. So the lens of the cybernetician toward this general topic of resilience today. I'd like to start with a first order view. This is a first order view. This is a loop. This is very typical. We take an action toward a goal. We see how that action has an effect. We measure the effect and we loop. Circular causal loop. I think cybernetic models are important for many reasons, partly because they involve human agency and goal and purpose and intention and desire. They also involve mechanical systems, things that we want to tame, like this HVAC system that just went off, which I'm so happy about. Here's a more formal example. I apologize if it's a bit small. This is the one of a thermostat room, not of a more modern type. We have a heater. The heater changes the temperature in the room. The temperature is measured by, in this case, a bimetallic coil. Lovely old reference. The temperature as measured by the coil is compared to the desired temperature, in this case 68 degrees. The mechanics of it does that comparison, and then the heater is either kept on or allowed to go off, depending on what the situation is. This can be formalized in this way. We sense, we compare, we act. We see the effect of the act on the sensor, and we compare to goal, and so on. Why am I going here? This is first order. This is the foundation. It's the foundation not just of cybernetic thinking in the first order, but also, as you'll see, where we end up toward resilience. When teaching this, students love to do designs, and they love to say, this is what my design does. And then I ask them the question, what does your design not do? And they're challenged by this question. But if you don't know what it doesn't do, then you don't know what you're designing. Now, cybernetics affords a wonderful way of thinking about this. For example, let's look at the sensor. How powerful is the sensor to react to the situation that it obtains in this particular room? And we break this down into resolution, frequency, and range. By resolution, we mean, to what fraction of a degree Fahrenheit will this sensor be able to sense? Within a degree, within a half a degree, within a millionth of a degree? How about a millionth? Do I hear a millionth? We don't need a millionth of a degree. It doesn't have to be that careful. Perhaps a half a degree is enough. Why? Because we're trying to create a temperature in the room that's comfortable for me. Well, I probably can't tell the difference of more than a half a degree. Okay, fine, a quarter of a degree, I give you a quarter. We don't need a million. So what am I describing here? I'm describing how careful do we have to be? How subtle does our measurement have to be in terms of resolution? There's also the notion of frequency. How often can it measure that? Does it have to measure it a million times a second? No. How often should it? Well, as often as I need, because the room is going to be changing its temperature every few seconds. So that's probably good enough. You get the point. You can look at the sensor as having a capacity to do its job. How well does it do it? By breaking it down into these three areas: resolution, frequency, and range. Now, the same is true of the actuator. In this case, the air conditioner, not the heater. I apologize, I should have flipped it. So how quickly can the heater go on and heat the room? How long does it take to change the temperature in the room? If it takes an hour to go from 60 degrees to 70 degrees, that's terrible. I'm not going to be comfortable during that period of time. So I need more capacity in the heater. Well, where I'm going here, as those of you who understand this ahead of time know, is I'm talking about the variety of these components. Variety is a concept that comes from cybernetics. It's a very specific idea that I wanted to go into a little more now because, as you might imagine, it has something to do with resilience. So the conventional English definition, I love this, speckled, variegated, hence manifold, diverse. It comes from Old French. It means difference or discrepancy in one sense. Even the dictionary knows it's a number of different types of things. Now, we're interested in a number of different types of states. Because in cybernetics, Ashby, who used variety extensively, as you all know, spoke of it as the total number of possible states of a system. And he has a few other definitions that I invite you to read. They're all useful in their own way. Variety absorbs variety, or as we sometimes hear, variety eats variety. I want to propose a less formal definition just for the sake of the discussion that's about to come. Capabilities, breadth. So we can cool the room now and we can probably heat it, but we cannot change its humidity. We cannot change the number of particulates in the air because the system doesn't have that variety. It has a limited variety. Capabilities and capacities of a system to respond to changes in its environment in order to reach its goal. So the system elements we have to play with from a first-order cybernetic point of view are set points or goals, sensors, comparators, actuators. And Ashby also brings in this idea of essential variables, which are measures of a system's operation that are interdependent. So in the body, the essential variables are my temperature, the amount of oxygen in my blood, the respiration rates, and body temperature, of course, glucose levels. These are all different levels that are important to maintain. These are the essential variables for me. How are these maintained in an organization? Who does this when it's a business or a school or a nonprofit? I would claim that these are business targets and values. This is what we want. This is what we set our sights on. And these others are more or less the responsibility of people and processes, AI notwithstanding. I also claim with a colleague, and I'll bring back this in a few minutes, that there are things that are called social essential variables, namely the shared truths in our organization that are our beliefs. And it's these things that we need to maintain in order to be sure that we are ourselves, that we are not being destroyed, that we are not dying in the sense that this system would die or this system would die if the essential variables were not maintained. So all of these are ways of talking about sources of the system's variety. So we've been talking about design and cybernetics. The title of the talk goes through resilience, so let's talk about resilience for a moment. It comes from the Latin salire, meaning to jump or leap. So resilience is to leap back. I believe Pile referred to this yesterday as well. So this is one definition from the dictionary, power, ability to return to the original form. We had a wonderful discussion yesterday about what we meant by original form. And do we want it to be what it was exactly before? Or is it possible or even preferential for it to be something new? Can resilience lead to an evolution into something new? It's a very important question. And it's a more common term to recover from illness, depression, adversity, and so on. If you do the Google Ngram fun, you can see how much resilience, 1940, it came up a little bit then, 60, 80. 80, it really started to bounce. Now, this only goes up to 2008, which is really unfortunate. If you go to Amazon, there are over 2,400 titles with resilience in the title in the last 9 years. And there have been 750 books published in the last 18 months alone with resilience in the title. Some of these may be republishings, but not, mostly not. Now, I want to propose an actionable definition grounded in what I've been saying before about cybernetics. So this is my proposed definition. The continuous regulation of variety. Now, I have to explain what that means in a social system and a linguistically-based, language-based system, but I'll come back to that in a moment. Designing for conversation, which you'll hear more about in my talk, is also a way of achieving resilience. It's another way of phrasing continuous regulation variety. It's a specific example of that. By the way, these slides are online, and I'll let you know the URL when we're done. So it's designing for conversation in social systems to achieve responsive, proactive internal change as a means of maintaining stability in the face of continuous external change. So this quality of resilience could be substituted or interpreted here as variety, and the discussion today is design of conversations for variety. It's just a way of paraphrasing and thinking about it. So let's see how design, and specifically second-order cybernetics, comes into play. You may recognize the beginning of a famous definition of design. I love to stop here because it starts with this phrase, everyone designs. So it's not the domain of rarefied people who claim to be designers who have particular degrees. Everyone designs, who devises courses of action aimed, cybernetic term, aimed at changing existing conditions into preferred ones. This is a pure cybernetic definition if I've ever heard one. Simon, in his book Sciences of the Artificial, does have a footnote with the word cybernetics in it. But it's kind of like, oh yeah, that's that thing over there. But this, it seems to me, is right square in the middle of that. So this is Herbert Simon. There are, of course, other definitions. And we owe it to Ranolf to just go right at it. Design and cybernetics are really the same thing. I like the really part. Dear Ranolf, we miss him. Here's another direct way of saying it. Conversation is the bridge between cybernetics and design. So a little excursion into some work of a colleague of mine and I, Hugh Dubberly, where we construe design as conversations for action, that is, cybernetics. And we believe it's a necessary foundation for 21st century practice. Let me try to convince you of that. Okay. So we claim that if you're doing design, you need systems. For a number of reasons. Certainly, digital technology is everywhere. Digital is systems of systems. This thing is not a system, it's a system of systems. And designing for this is very complex. It's a piece of hardware connected to software, connected to a network, connected to software, connected to databases, connected to commerce systems, connected to other databases, connected, you get it. Systems of systems. Internet of Things is also a great example of this. And design also, we would argue, this is not contentious, has gone from giving form, making objects, or making objects to be made, such as manufacturing chairs, into creating systems that support interactions, of which this is one. And service design, of course, is the classic way of talking about this. Human interactions span thinking and acting, right? Whether mundane or metaphysical. And mechanical systems span these things as well. So in order to tame this complex mesh of mechanisms, we argue that systems literacy, reading and writing and understanding systems, is a necessary foundation. And I convey to Dubberly's writing on this, which is, I think, is stupendous, about systems literacy. Now, if you're dealing with systems, we claim you have to deal with cybernetics. I don't think I have to push that too hard. But the science of communication and feedback, or any definition you want, with or without the word science in it, has the power to talk about systems with intention, and also things like this, which keep on going on and annoying the hell out of us. But that's just the way it goes. So a single framework in which to talk about communication, intention, in a common frame is very, very powerful. Now, this will be no surprise. If cybernetics, then second order. Why? Well, because framing these wicked challenges that I mentioned earlier is a matter of framing, because there's no right answer, there's no objective truth. It's a matter of bringing values and subjective viewpoints into the frame to look in a way, to see in a way such that we might formulate a problem and then solve it. So modeling subjectivity is the province of second order. We need it. We would also claim that subjectivity is the creation of a language in which you see. And we'll come back to the idea of creating language later. Now, if you're doing second order cybernetics, you have to be able to do conversation, because taming these wicked challenges, as Riddle speaks of tremendously, is a question of argumentation. My colleague Walter Lee has written beautifully on this. If you can't argue it, you can't make a point that others will see and that will be convincing, and that therefore you can't coordinate action and collaborate and go forward. So you must have conversation. So the heart of 21st century design, we would claim, is conversation. And we meet it in the rich second order sense. Now, there are two senses in which I want to talk about conversation. I've been saying that design is conversation, or design as conversation. But also, if design is conversation, and we as designers want to help other people design, work with me here, then we need to facilitate and foster conversation for others. So we are designing the conditions for conversation. So we make this simple as saying, design as conversation, one way to think about it, and designing for conversation. So the goal of the designer is to enable conversation, because we're responsible to give others the best possible tools to achieve what they want, to achieve what they want in complex and wicked situations. Conversation is necessary, and therefore we have to enable conversation. So these two senses of conversation, design as conversation and design for enabling others to do conversation, is key. Or, as Ranville again cuts right to the chase, design is the action, second order cybernetics is the explanation. Now, we can't talk about second order without talking about Heinz, of course. And we can't talk about conversation without talking about Gordon Pask and his development of conversation theory, which is a theory of cooperation, collaboration, and many other things, is core. Here's an example of collaboration. Here's another example of conversation. G. Spencer Brown. And I love this look on Gordon's face when he looks. And because it's this group, I can't help but show these photos. And here's a selfish one. This is me and Gordon. I spend a lot of time with Gordon, as Michael said. I was a student and collaborator for some number of years, doing contracts for the U.S. and U.K. Groups in psychology and training and so on and so forth. Story for another time. And he developed this extraordinary theory, extraordinary because it's not widely shared and yet, I think, universally applicable. This says observers recording equipment, because he set up the notion that you have to have an experimental situation between an alpha and a beta, as he would say. And some interface has to understand, has to observe what's going on between. And he developed a series of diagrams in a formalism, which is really elegant and has a series of equations associated with it. Here we get into multiple layers and the coordination of action, as Maturana would call languaging. And not only is it between an A and a B, but there are multiple layers that an observer may say is going on. So this is the part of the conversation that's about goals. Hey, let's go to dinner. Great, I'd love to. And this is the layer of conversation about means. Well, I'd like to go to Italian food. Let's walk. No, I'd rather eat Thai food. These are multiple layers that an observer sees in conversations like this. So any formulation of goals and any formulation of means to achieve the goals can be captured by this. And these become more elaborate. This is the most general form This includes, by the way, caring, which came up yesterday. Fortunately, there's not enough time to go into that, but I can assure you it's true. But where I'm trying to get to is an argument from the earlier first-order models through this and then back to the notion of design. Well, this and this are the same. So what have I done? I've simply superimposed individual first-order feedback loops on top of his cross. And as before, we're concerned with the variety of the sensor, the actuator, and the comparator, which in their own ways represent the power and limitations of the system to do what we want it to do. And the same is true in a conversation interface. So again, left side is one participant A, the right is a different participant. And these different levels are an observer saying, well, that's a discussion about goals, and this is a discussion about means. And there's variety in these sensors and actuators and comparators as before. And the nature of that variety, we'll just keep going. The nature of that variety is important, and we'll come back to it in a minute. But how does conversation work? This is always the important question. This is an abstraction that I've taken out of conversation theory. So people often say after I talk about it, it's not that simple.
Right.
But that's really kind of trivial.
Yes.
I knew that before. Good. The point is, we want to look at it, at the abstraction, to pull some things out of it for a purpose that will emerge later on. So participant A has a goal. It might be mundane, it might be metaphysical, as I said earlier. It might be to go to dinner, it might be to have a wonderful relationship, it might be to form a plan to tame a wicked problem. And given this goal, A chooses a context in which to begin the conversation. Now this context is multidimensional. It may be a point in time, has to be a point in time. But it may also be a situation that is appropriate. And that may be as a result of an accumulated experience, or might just be someone walking up to you right now and saying, excuse me, I'd like to have a conversation with you. But having chosen the context, also a language has to be chosen. And not just English, but terms and values, I think I would also claim. But certainly an initial contact that will make sense to participant B, because there's no point in initiating something in a language that makes no sense. So the exchange begins by an action taken by A to B. And now B has an interesting challenge, because this stimulus, one way of thinking it, input, another bad way of thinking it, this trigger, good way of thinking about it, comes to participant B, and many, many possibilities may exist for B as she evaluates what's going on. I hope you could see those. Maybe you can. But in any event, if B has a goal that is consonant with A, then the exchange begins and the action invokes a reaction, and there's a back and forth. And this back and forth engagement may continue until one says, no, I'm out. An agreement may come, maybe an agreement to disagree, of course. And as a result of that agreement, an action or even a transaction — transaction is a very transactional word, it's a very concrete word, but it's sometimes true — I will give you this if you give me that, or we will do this together, can be many, many different things. But it's a commitment to act together. So this is a way of reducing conversation to simple elements. If you want to remember this, there's a very simple acronym called CLEAT, which is the context, the language, the engagement, the potential of agreement, and action or transaction. It's just a way of thinking about that. And there's a reason for laying this groundwork. So we're back to design. Second, how's your resilience doing? Hanging in there? Okay, good. I have at least one nod. I'll take one nod. That's good. So this next excursion is, again, an attempt to start in a familiar place. So I'm creating a context that many of you will know, and I'll explain briefly for those of you who don't know. You might think of this next section of my talk as repeal and replace of design thinking. I don't mean design thinking in the sense of branding of what the design school at Stanford does, or IDEO's marketing ideas, IDEO being the company that has made this well known. But what I mean is a counter to analytical thinking and the idea that design should be everywhere in the process. Those ideas about design thinking I like. But what design thinking is usually described as these steps: to observe something, usually in the sense of user studies, sort of ethnography light, to brainstorm ideas, and then to prototype. My objection is that, in general, design thinking is proposed as a way of doing innovation. It's like, you do these things, hey, innovation, you got it. And this bothers me because it's a false claim. I think it's a false claim for a lot of reasons. The evaluation of these steps is very loose. There aren't rules or even much about them. You know, you have post-it notes over here, and then you have grouped post-it notes over there for the brainstorming. What does that mean? I'm not sure. And even as you iterate and evaluate the prototype, you don't necessarily have established what it is you want to converge on. It's just kind of all out there, and you iterate, and you know you're getting better because you're iterating, right? That's what iteration means. Well, of course, as we said yesterday, iteration literally means repetition. They mean recursion. They don't make that distinction. But we're doing the best we can. So my questions are, how specific and rigorous and repeatable, and how clear and quantifiable and directed this process is. You could say it comes down to measuring, right? So we want to measure some improvement for users by going through this process. Did they get what they wanted? What do they want? Do we know what they wanted? Oh yeah, we study them and we ask them what they wanted, so we must kind of know. But there are also measures from the designer's perspective. Do we converge on the design goals? What was our measure of success? Did we specify that? I don't hear that when I hear design thinking spoken of. But let me drop back. All of this, I would claim, is a desire to get clearer on how we're going to do what we're going to do. This is all about how, right? So I would synopsize these as, it's a conversation to agree on means, right? Because if you're observing, and if you're brainstorming, and you're prototyping, there are conversations in all of those. But a summary might be a conversation to agree on means. So this is great. We're going to agree on the means to achieving the goals of ourselves and our... I'm sorry, did I hear the word goals? I think I heard the word goals. So conversation is the core, but there's something about this. There's nothing here about goals. So wait a minute. Are we going to talk about goals? Think that's a good idea? I think it's a good idea. So at least this design thinking thing, which I'm going to simplify down to be conversation to agree on means, is one of at least two conversations, the others which a conversation to agree on goals. Is this making sense? Where are the goals in the design thinking thing? Well, they're embedded. They're implicit. They're not called out. So I'm really taking advantage of Pask here, who wants to say that there are different levels of conversation. And let's be clear about that difference. And let's iterate and evaluate across this divide. What does that mean? Well, surely we have to ask the question that if we do this, do we achieve this? By which I mean, we have a conversation to agree on the means. We've agreed on the means. We're going to make X in the following way. If we make X, do we get what we want X to do? It's a question of evaluation. Well, this feels like a bit of an advance. I felt good when I got this far. And then, of course, the question is, any questions? What's the first question that comes to mind? Peter.
Well, my reaction would be,
Why prior?
Because means are driven by the goals. Means have to be consistent with the goals. And so, you know, you can talk about how to build a bridge, but if you're not agreed on what sorts of things are going to go over that bridge or why you're doing it.
So this doesn't specify an order. I think you're agreeing with my complaint about what's inside here, which is where design thinking sits. They do talk about the goals, but they don't necessarily surface them first, and also they allow them to emerge from the discussions with users. And there's a controversy about that.
The clients are driving the goals, and it's all preset.
Right, but they may not have the right goal, and on and on and on. So don't take a temporal order from this. The thing that stood out for me is, who's in these damn conversations? I mean, it's like, whoa, that was a thunderclap. Who's in the conversations? Who do we put in the conversations such that we can achieve what we want? Well, it's a question of variety. If we want to agree on the goals, do we have sufficient variety in the conversation to achieve the goals? What does that mean? Do we have people of the right range of expertise? Do they have the language to sense what's going on in the environment? Do we have a richness of points of view, diversity is a common word used here, in that conversation such that we can get what we want. So I want to have this conversation explicitly. I want to say, I want to design the designing by saying who is in this conversation and why, and indeed who is in this conversation and why. And I want to iterate and evaluate across them all. So there's also this question of making sure that as I look back and forth and reflect on what I've done, that I've gotten it to the right place. So this is all about variety. Well, seems important now to ask the question, how do we design a conversation for variety? Right. So I'm going to take you through a little project. You have a conversation with people in it. These are people, participants. And presumably a conversation builds new knowledge. We learn something. If we learn nothing, then I don't think we had a conversation. We had a nice dinner. We got drunk. Maybe not. But it's not enough. So as a result of what we learned, when we have the next conversation, there are things we want to do in this next conversation. So we're anticipating what's coming next. We may not be perfect in our anticipation, but we should think ahead. So what questions do we want to answer next? What is the goal for the next conversation? Well, the people in that conversation maybe are different than the people in this conversation, because the variety we need here may be different. So how do we select new participants for the new variety? Well, the existing participants in our pool become possible participants. And then we ask, who do we keep and who would we be missing if we only kept these people into the next one? So we have a selection criteria for who should be in the next conversation. We also need new knowledge for that conversation, presumably. So I'm sorry, I'm doing it in a slightly awkward way. What we learned implies who we need next. It implies the information we need next, and we should bring the new people and the new information to the next conversation. So this becomes a selection mechanism. So I'm trying to answer the question, how do we design who's in the next conversation? Because my claim is variety in the conversation is key. We have to design each conversation, my claim again, and therefore this would be a mechanism for doing it. So being careful to think about this in advance, selecting for the requisite variety with no guarantees that we'll achieve it is my focus for designing conversations for variety. Now, this can become a pattern. This is a fairly standard cadence that's used. So a client calls, you have some ideation sessions, also known as brainstorming. You propose a solution and make it, you deliver it, and then you evaluate it. And each of these has this pattern. So what I'm saying in general is don't design the team, design the cadence of conversations.
Now, I want to skip over this. Sometimes people say, well, what's the reward structure, and on, but I'm going to skip ahead. Forgive me for just doing that and saying that it's a little bit too involved for the time I have today. But I can answer the question on another occasion. So here we are. I just tried to explain a process that takes place inside this box, and of course, as you see, I'm implying that there's something missing. What I want to put in this box is the deep challenge of innovation. This is a phrase that haunts us all. It's older than resilience, but maybe equally tired. Every startup wants to innovate. Every government wants to innovate. And I see very, very weak explanations of what that might mean. So what is this? Well, I want to go back to Heinz for a minute and introduce another character, Michael Gagan, who many of you know. He was for many years at DuPont, and we've sort of traded at different times being each other's clients. Don Schoen, myself, Michael Gagan, Gordon, and Frank Galushka, a former president of ASC. As a consequence of the interactions with Michael over many years, and the influence of Schoen, and the influence of Pask, and the influence of Maturana, and others, in general the influence of cybernetics, Michael and I and Hugh Dubberley and Peter Esmond produced this book, which some of you have seen. It's a little pamphlet. And the goal of this book is to explain how organizations fail. Specifically, how organizations that are very, very successful go up and up and up and up, and then they crash and burn and they go to zero, which is much more common than a company existing for 100 years. Much, much, much more common that they fail. And this is that brief explanation. Again, on a trajectory to explain how do you innovate and how do you fill in that fourth box. So our claim is in an organization is its language. Now, by language, I don't mean English. I mean, what are its distinctions? It's the relations in the words that it uses to describe what it does and doesn't do. And what are the conversations it can have? A nice summary is, if you can't talk about it, you can't do anything about it. Well, what's the it? The it is not the objective reality out there. The it is the distinctions that you use in order to operate in the world as you see it, such that you can do effective business and make a profit. If you don't have the right language, the right distinctions and relationships, things will happen in the environment that you cannot even see. And this is the opening point of this. Now, businesses, in order to get more and more efficient, narrow their language because it increases their efficiency. So you have acronyms, you have shorthand, you have history amongst each other where you don't have to repeat everything six times. This is a kind of efficiency, and it gets you better and better and better at making the same thing cheaper. The problem can be, however, that narrowing the language also increases ignorance. The example that Mike Gagan likes to use is General Motors got spectacularly good at making the wrong car cheaper because they didn't have the language to see what was going on in Japan. It's not that they saw what was going on and they said, well, we're not going to do that, we're fine. They couldn't even see it. Bill Gates, when he saw that there was a distinction between software and hardware that he could take advantage of by separating them out and selling them separately, that was an innovation. That's a language issue. That's a set of distinctions that didn't exist in IBM's mind. They couldn't see the value of it. And there can be other examples. So if narrowing language increases ignorance, then the past language limits the future vision, right? Because you can't see where things are going in the future. So what's the antidote? Expanding language increases opportunity. Therefore, to regenerate an organization has to create new language, new distinctions, new relations, new ways of seeing, such that the future can be parsed in a new way and therefore wealth created in new ways. So many startups do this, right? Uber, despite its politics, not talking about its politics. There's a wonderful distinction between Amazon and Alibaba in China. Alibaba in China does not own giant warehouses and employ 100,000 people. but it does the same thing that Amazon does, and it does it more efficiently because it's this whole thing of bits instead of atoms, which is another way of saying that new economy successes participate in this idea that moving information around is cheaper and more efficient than moving things around. Anyway, so what's in this box? What's in this box is the conversation to create new language. Now, how do you do that? Another wonderful question. So I have some hints. I'm testing your resilience, I know. But I'm going to go very quickly through these and then wrap up. This idea of a focusing question for an organization is, if an organization tries to solve its entire problem to move from one market to a more modern market, if it tries to do it all at once, it will fail. It's boiling the ocean. It's too much to do all at once. So how do you focus down on a question that's narrow enough to do something about, to be tractable, to tame at least? And yet if you solve that problem, then you can replicate that solution in many different ways or expand it in breadth and overtake a larger market. This is a design problem of its own, and it's a variety challenge of its own. But just very quickly, just to show you that I'm not saying, oh, there's a magic box and you can, you know, figure it out for yourself. This is the point about Adam Stibitz I was just making. It has to participate in the new economy. Otherwise, it's a 20th century business instead of a 21st century business. It has to be able to remove uncertainty in the marketplace to create order from disorder or to do something that has value. All of these are worth doing. This third one that I didn't mention is lowering the cost of a human to achieve a goal. These are ways of creating wealth. It has to be consistent with the current organization. It can't be completely inconsistent, because otherwise it's, you know, it becomes a cancer on the side, and it will never be able to healthfully grow into the full organization and make it something new. You have to engage the individuals who want to do it. You can't force it on an organization. Well, actually, you can. So Lou Gerstner did that in the 90s at IBM when he fired all of the people that he thought weren't going to get it as middle managers, and he changed the language by saying, we're not doing hardware, we're doing services. And there were particular design agencies involved in that helped change that language. That's a story for another time. But you don't want to force people to do it. You want to find the people who really want to, show that it can succeed. Then the 80% of the people who are a little bit skittish now see that they're a success, so they come with you. And then that last 10%, you're never going to get those. Sorry. Just let them go or give them pensions or protect them in the ways that you wish. But they will never be convinced to come over. It's a pragmatic, if a bit brutal, view. And then reveal the necessary variety. So again, always be conscious of variety and what's required. And finally, teach the organization as a whole, so take seriously the idea of taking that example, that focusing question, and solving that as a microcosm and bringing that to the entire organization. I cheated. I want to make another brief excursion, because to speak of organizations, you have to speak of Stafford Beer, and you have to speak of his viable system model. And my thanks to Elena Leonard for pointing out this particular version of this. And we've had a brief conversation about it. Everything I say is full of my own errors and not attributable to her. This is the system 3, 4, and 5. System 1 and 2 are part of the means. But I want to try to make a correspondence between what I've been talking about and Beer's model. I think it's important to do that. You can't talk about organizational systems without both playing homage to Beer, but also trying to make some links. So my feeling is that system three, which is about the inside and the now, is, although part of system one and two as part of the means, is really substantially the conversation to agree on means. System four, which is described as outside in the future, that sounds like goals to me. And that's agreement to agree on goals. The so-called 3-4 homeostat is part of that as well. balances present and future needs. And then system five, I believe, is a kind of hybrid. It's about monitoring the future. And for me, it's about designing the design and creating new language. So this is a very crude and early thing that I would love to talk more with Elena about. And of course, the CyberSyn project was replete with these ideas. And it's fractal, so inside of these other systems are the same sets. Very beautiful and elegant model, partly based on the nervous system, as I think you know. And again, this is a very early desire and attempt to show some correspondence from them all. Okay, so we're in the home stretch. I want to go back to the paper that Deborah and I have written recently for the design cybernetics book that Candy and Tom are working on, and just to make some assertions. So as I said at the beginning, we construe design as conversation for action, that is cybernetics. An action may either conserve or change a situation. And again, back to Maturana, design is a conversation about what to conserve and what to change, conversation about what we value. So it has this form of living together and languaging. Now, if we converse explicitly about goals, we're transparent about frames and values. So to us, this is ethical, to be transparent about our values. If we converse about the means to achieve those goals, then we better engage participants and we improve outcomes. This is collaborative. If we converse to co-evolve new language, we can escape the limitations of current viewpoints, create new frames and possibilities. This is innovative. And lastly, if we converse about the design process itself, designing the designing, then we enter all conversations as participants answerable for our actions. This is responsible. And this would be my summary of design of conversations for action. These are the challenges. We propose a term, second order design, meaning design for conversation, which is defined as facilitating the emergence of conditions in which others can design. As I said, design for conversation, for others, and to create conditions in which conversations can emerge and thus increase the number of choices open to all. And as we heard yesterday, a version of this, this is Heinz's slight correction where he says, instead of, I shall act always. Because the first version of this that was quoted yesterday is, act always. And that sounds like a demand. And that's in his wonderful paper on invention and discovery. That crosses the line between ethics, which is I am going to act in the way I want, toward morality, which is I'm going to tell you how to behave. So this is a revision that came later, which I think is very beautiful. I shall act always so as to increase the total number of choices. And I love this part. If you desire to see, learn how to act. So conversations for action. Anyway, that's what I wanted to say today. I hope you'll test my resilience now with your questions and challenges. Thank you very much. Nokia and BlackBerry is a great example. Well, Microsoft is a good example in the one I gave, which Gates made the leap of understanding selling software separately, was extraordinary. But later, he didn't get the internet, and he didn't get browsers. Couldn't see what was going on because he was desktop focused and person in chair sitting at a desk focused. And those computers didn't do networking very well in that era anyway when it emerged. So there was no language for understanding what that might be. I don't know. I don't want to put you on the spot, Walter, but are there other examples that come to mind of not having a language to see and therefore limiting? I mean, DuPont was another example. That was one of the reasons why he was...
Repeat the question when you can.
Okay, thank you. Yes?
Andy Grossbook, The Inflection Point.
Andy Grossbook, The Inflection Point?
Yeah.
What does he say there?
Well, he said that Intel got to a point where their market had changed. They didn't see it exactly what they didn't see. It, basically, they were the dominant player for a long time in semiconductor memory, and then the Japanese outspent them, basically, and took over that market.
Yep.
And they were starting to fail.
Yep.
80 or 90% of their company is doing that. Yep. And they had this other little group that was doing microprocessors over in the corner. And
so that transition to microprocessors.
I can't tell you specifically what they didn't see, but for a long time, they thought of themselves as in the semiconductor business and the big player in that. And when that started failing, they had a crisis, and they made it through, unlike a lot of companies, because
they squeezed through.
Yeah, they squeezed through, and it was very traumatic. But basically, they decided 80% of their business they were going to get out of.
Understood. Tom, do you have
an example? I'm not sure if you agree, but Sony repackaging a recorder for journalists with a headset, and thereby creating new language, going from one paradigm to another without really changing the product, in creating Walkman.
Yeah, understood. That's interesting. That's sort of a hybrid case, it sounds like. So that's not failing to see, but it's making a transition and then seeing that transition in a new way.
They just got to see.
So. They didn't see that this was going to be a way of people walking around listening to music. At first, when they made the version that you first referred to, their transition to create the product was not for the mass market. They saw the mass market only after they made the product itself. So what I usually like to say is, when people say, that's a great new technology, usually my response is, no, you're missing something. It was a great new idea from which came the technology. For example, you can't build the iPhone without conceiving it first. So in that case, Jobs saw, and they made something new from the new language that they created. I think your Sony case is one where they didn't see where it was going, but they made it, and then having made it, they could say, wow, that's a great new technology. We can use that in this place that we didn't expect. So I think it's a variable example. Walter, any thoughts on that?
Well, yeah, with the topic you talked about, the Jobs example is interesting because I hate to say it, Jobs went back to the great man theory of innovation, what you're talking about, mm-hmm. And when the great man stumbles, things tend to go to hell in a handbasket, fairly quickly. But, throughout the entire high tech, growth was one, it didn't stop. It was growth who drove that, and did that. And growth was one guy
the change.
Who did that. I noticed that at IBM, for all whatever the bristle, it doesn't compare to the original Watson's father and son team, who basically bet this entire company on an operating system, and they went out of business on it. But the thing is, the point where back to great man is that they are the people that are basically free from the organizational constraints that most of us operate under. I mean, I tried to do it at IBM, my head would be handed to me on a silver platter. But the two founders could do that. Bill Gates could do it for Microsoft. I'll bet you his was Dennis manifestly didn't do it or couldn't do it.
Yeah, they may have had the idea, but they couldn't bring it forward.
It does often depend, unfortunately, on the people that are participating.
The individual.
Jobs is a clear example of that. I mean, created Apple. It was astronomically successful. You got thrown out, went down the tubes, came back. Yeah. iPod, and you know.
How much time?
Now the issue is, you know, what are they doing now? They're buying back their stock. To me, that tells them they basically shot their innovation bolt. That's, you know, I worry about the future of that company, even though its stock price is as high as it's ever been, you know, and
yeah.
You know, markets say it's doing well. I look at what they've been doing and you know, think, all you guys can do is buy back your stock. You know, I honestly, you know, I am losing faith in you.
So the question is the next innovation. The discussions of things in the home and cars and et cetera, but we haven't seen those yet. Yeah. Other questions? Yeah,
Keelan. We've had this conversation before, and I'm seeing a new insight, and this is why do we start with goals in the center and then the comparator? Because I don't see that necessarily being the case for all conversations. It's clearly that for a conversation for action. And I can even see it in this particular conversation I'm having you. It's a conversation for understanding. There's a desire. But maybe that's not what the fundament is. Maybe you could come to that by looking at it from the thermostat principle, where there is a specific externally set goal and then a comparator to do that.
Great.
But let's say a baby cries. It's not crying with the goal. It is crying because it's uncomfortable. And the mother determines that the goal is to be fed.
So this is another wonderful example where on presenting, what's implied is not intended. So I don't think goals come first. And I didn't really go into this when Peter raised this question. It's a circle, and you can start anywhere, both an explanation and an action. And of course, Heinz says, in order to see, learn how to act, he would claim that action comes first. And I agree with all those things. You don't have to talk about the goals first. You can get a bunch of people in a room and you can play with all of these objects on the table to try to make something and then later decide what the goal of that something is.
Like
now,
the headphones.
Yes, yes. Now very often in design situations or in organizations, it is led by some upper level thing because that's the tendency. But it doesn't have to be, and the models don't have to be construed that way. Klaus.
Or the telephone. Was not invented to talk, was to transmit music because someone couldn't come to the concert. Edison didn't invent the talk that came later.
I'm sorry, Graham Bell invented the telephone because he understood that people couldn't hear well, and he understood how speech worked, and therefore did invent it in order to...
The transmission idea was there.
After the transmission, yes, okay.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's a mess, right? Goals are not always coming from the right fundament, and they're not always the place to start. It's a much messier thing than the diagrams thing. I know what you mean about gold in the middle, and maybe that's a forefront thing that's a little unfair.
Coherence rather than comparator, because
yes.
There's not necessarily a pre-existing condition to compare them.
Great. So for sense making. And for the general case of social interactions, I like very much the word coherence, of course. Kapaski said it as well. But to start from the mechanical model, comparator is just the place to start. I'm sorry, Michael.
Can you go back to your slide that showed the cadence of conversation?
Sure. I can do that.
In the meantime, I'm going to say something. Never mind.
Sorry, I was too fast. You can be next.
So, whenever I am either teaching or sitting in, having to go through the pain of sitting in a discussion of what is a good sales process and good sales conversations, they reproduce some form of this.
Yes.
And they're always saying that the goal is always the call to action in the next conversation.
Mm-hmm.
My usual reaction to that is that this diagram hides another separation.
Okay.
So I'd like to bring that separation out because it comes out really clearly in sales conversations.
Okay.
You can do this diagram with a drive toward a transaction. When the drive is toward a transaction, the goal has come first. You can do the same diagram with a goal of relationship.
Yes.
And when you do the relationship, the means comes first, and the goals all sort of fall off to the side and happen later.
Maybe. I mean,
I'm telling you from a sales perspective.
Okay. I'm sorry. Good.
Okay.
Good.
I want to just draw the distinction there because they pull up a very similar chart.
Nice.
And then suggest that it's got these two other dimensions, and you have to decide as a salesperson.
I see.
What are you doing?
I see.
If you're after a transaction, then the next step is things that lead to the transaction, goal first all the time.
Whereas
if you're after the relationship, you worry about the goals later.
It feels like you could apply that to companies who now seek to form the relationship before they get the transaction. So brands want to establish the connection to the market in terms of conversations, or to host conversations, is how they talk about it, with consumers, and then later on worry about when the money flows.
Yeah. So then it's got one other interesting implication, which is when you do this with experienced salespeople, the presumption is that they know how to design the conversations for transactions.
Yes.
And that there's a lot of education, learning, and co-creation required to teach them how to go through the same process with respect to relationship. Mm-hmm. So moving the goal out of the center and putting the means in the center is an innovation.
Yes, very nice.
And that innovation demands a whole lot of design in the way you're talking about it in order to get these people to carry it out.
Yes, conversations to get them in that way. Judy.
I'm wanting to remind us that Stafford also said that models are not good or bad, but more or less useful.
Yep.
And this is a model. And it's useful in certain contexts and not useful, I think, in other contexts.
Of course.
It depends on one's desires.
Of course.
And so I just felt the need to say that.
Thank you very much. I'm sorry, someone new? Elena first, and then Tom.
I was wondering, thinking about the people and the businesses that have failed, about where is the place in some of these conversations for either King Lear School or in this integration situation, the role of the critic that has 10 minutes after out of every 60 to say what they think needs to be improved, and they don't always act in the fool role, but sometimes they do.
The fool is a fabulous example. By the way, Michael Gagan was featured in an article in the Financial Times with the title, big across the page, "The Jester Who Plays at the Court of DuPont," because he saw himself as the fool in the context of the DuPont conversation. And I think that's absolutely right. It's a massive injection of variety to have a fool because of the transparency with which he can speak and the incisiveness and the sharpness of it. So I think that's a really wonderful example of something that could be part of these design ideas, this integrity ideas. It's fantastic. And that could be an enhancement of what I've tried to present as the beginning of methods to try to do the two-by-two thing, which really needs a name. Maybe Tom's next one.
Yes. It looks all very polished.
I know. That's the problem.
What to you are the next tough nuts to crack in the development of conversational?
I've just been offered by a group at at Michigan State to create a microcosm study of this and to try to push it forward. And that would be done in some conjunction with my college, CCS, and we haven't started that conversation yet. But I don't think it's a matter of continuing to make, you know, flat squares with animation. I think it's a matter of finding specific examples to apply it to and to go the next layer in a methodology if possible. But also to look out in the world and see what is consistent with this model that might be case studies that we could draw on. So for me, that's the next step. Enough about this. Let's now go the next layer and see what we might get to.
Quick question.
Yeah.
Basing on Philip's conversation and yours, would you put goals or relationships in the center of education?
Whoa.
That's
like, when did you stop eating your wife? Seriously, it's a very complex question. I would prefer to favor relations, of course, because that's the foundation of the trust in an exchange in which learning can take place in an open and transparent way. So I think you can, I don't know that the goals alone are enough to get learning.
Yeah.
So.
Clearly not alone, but that's where you're in the center.
I can't imagine a sensor. It feels like a dynamic to me. That's a wonderful question. Thank you.
A follow-up on the Intel comment. I did remember an important part that fits into this, which is the innovation was done on the edge.
Yes.
With this group that made the conceptual leap from being called on by customers for custom logic circuits to general purpose microprocessors.
Yep.
And but that was being developed in the company on the edge.
Yes.
But then Grove was a fellow who recognized it as the solution.
Yep.
for the company.
So this reference to the little gray book, as we fondly refer to it, goes into that in some detail. Talking about the context in which any attempt to create the new language in the presence of the existing language and the business objectives, it gets killed. And so Skunk Works and Going to the Garage and all of these other literal stories of how the innovation takes place at the edge, it can take place in the context of this. The Great Book goes into it more. And there's a moment
here. Another quick example.
Yeah.
More in process than in product. Mm-hmm. Was during the 70s and 80s, John Deere had a consumer products plant out in Oregon, Wisconsin.
Okay.
Made their ski mobiles and their tractors and lawnmowers and that sort of stuff. Completely ignored by headquarters, and they had their own way. The headquarters were much more interested in micromanaging the tractor business and the industrial business. These guys were getting their lunch eaten by the Honda and the Japanese, and they were forced basically to go over and learn what the Japanese were doing, and they brought all that stuff back, all the just-in-time lean manufacturing, when the main company got into trouble in the 80s. It was the manager from that peripheral factory, a guy named Van Zandt, who got pulled back to corporate and had to basically save the whole company.
So that's a reminder, too, of total quality management, which Deming had to go to Japan to use, and then GM making the wrong car cheaper got caught, and then they had to quality and so on. We may have time for another question. One or two? Yeah. Who? Anyone we haven't heard from? Robert.
So I think what David presented was a very good example of creating conversations where a new language can come about, because he's working in a society where the professors do not understand the context from which the students come, and and the students don't understand the language that the professor expects them to understand. And so I think what he's described here is a way to create new language.
Great. That's a good example.
So you might comment on it.
No, I think
what he did is an example of your...
I think it is. It's a way of creating new relations such that they make sense in the context and constraints of what they're dealing with. Yeah, that's great. Candy, do you have something?
Yeah. It used to be that conversation was what occurred in between. And it gives me a little bit of a creepy feeling to see conversations suddenly in boxes. Mm-hmm. And maybe the things that we want to further develop cannot be in boxes. Maybe they have to be in between. And maybe if we want to continue to develop our understanding of what conversations are, which many of us are in the business of doing,
sure.
including you.
So this is a challenge of representation. There are relations between the boxes.
Yeah, but I think it's a bit more because we are now starting to advertise conversation. We are in education. We are pretending we know what that is. And, it would be great if we can keep a little bit of ambiguity there and a little bit of future.
I'd love to hear an alternative representation.
Hmm?
I'd love to hear an alternative for representing it, because it's a matter of building a model that you can then use as a visual that conveys the structure of what you want to keep. And but yes, I would love to have some ideas for that.
Okay, I think it's time to break for lunch, et cetera. So can we say thank you to Paul?
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
Lunch is in the next room. They have a shortage of chairs. So half of us will have to bring a chair with us. Oh, I'm sorry. We need the surveys.
Yes, I'll be coming.
Because my stuff just...
I'd love to...